Hello, and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
It's an insult! This is an insult!
Ambassador Kevin Vickers, the hero from the Parliament Hill terror attack, jumped into action again, this time in Ireland, as he tackled a protester at a memorial ceremony in Dublin. The incident has made headlines around the world and sparked debates about whether or not this scuffle was appropriate. To get his thoughts on the incident, I speak with the protester himself, Brian Murphy, who joins me on the phone from Dublin. It's a tale of two conventions, one of celebration and another of renewal. Both Liberal and Conservative members have been discussing the route forward for their parties, and we take you to both convention floors. First, to hear about the grit gathering in Winnipeg, we speak with McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes. Then, we head to Vancouver for the Conservative Conclave as we chat with Associate Editor Nancy MacDonald. And finally, the federal government is going to be changing the way Canadians vote. But as the debate begins about the different ways to reform our electoral system, how much of a role should gender equality play? I speak with the head of Equal Voice Canada. For your politics, for your power, welcome to the Hill.
There are currently Republican prisoners in jails across this country. Freedom for the Craig Evans Hill. It's an insult. This is an insult.
That was the sound on Thursday as Canada's ambassador to Ireland, Kevin Vickers, the hero from the Parliament Hill terror attack, scuffled with a protester at a memorial ceremony in Dublin. Here's what happened. Vickers had been attending this ceremony, which was honoring British soldiers who were killed in Ireland's 1916 Easter Rising. After dignitaries took their seats, a man stood up from the crowd and began shouting, "This was an insult." He walked towards the podium, and that's when Ambassador Vickers got up, grabbed the man by both shoulders, wrestled with the protester, and dragged him off to the side so police could intervene. Now, it shouldn't have been a surprise that this event would spark a protest, given the fact that the Easter Rising was an armed rebellion against British rule that helped lead to Ireland's independence. This event honored the British soldiers. But the incident has sparked a debate here in Canada about whether Vickers' actions were appropriate or not. Some say an ambassador should not have been engaging in this way with a non-violent protester and shouldn't have been getting involved in the domestic politics of another country. On the other hand, there are many who say he had the right to act, especially if he perceived a legitimate safety threat. You may remember Vickers as a sergeant-at-arms who shot and killed Michael Zahaf Babo, the assailant who killed Corporal Nathan Cirillo and then stormed Centre Block in October of 2014. You may not know the man who was protesting. His name is Brian Murphy. His grandfather actually fought in the Easter Rising on the rebel side. His great-grandfather on the other side of his family was actually a member of the British Army and stationed all around the world, including Halifax, where his grandmother was born. And Murphy is a part of a group called Irish Republican Prisoners Welfare Association, which, among other things, has been fighting for the release of two people convicted in the murder of a police officer in Northern Ireland. The group claims the men are innocent, and that was one of the things Murphy was yelling out in his scuffle with Vickers. Well, to talk more about this whole incident and the actions of the ambassador, I'm joined on the phone now by the protester himself. Brian Murphy joins me from Dublin.
Thank you for calling me. Nice to talk to you.
First of all, how did you get into this event?
Yeah, I suppose, I applied through one of the government departments. There was you could apply through the website. So I sent off my details, asked could I attend the event. I suppose the connection I have to the cemetery is that my great-grandfather, who was in the British Army, is actually buried in the cemetery. I received the invitation, and on Thursday I headed off into the cemetery.
While the ceremony was happening, why did you decide to get up and protest?
I suppose the two main things, in my own family history, apart from one side of the family, the British Army connection, the other side of the family, have quite deep roots in sort of the Irish sort of struggle for independence. And I suppose over this year, there's been various events that I sound to my mind, you know, I haven't felt have properly honoured the sacrifice of those who fought and in some cases died for Irish freedom. This particular event I found very objectionable in that it was commemorating British soldiers who fought against the Irish rebels, and you know, I'm aware a number of atrocities committed during the Easter Rising. You know, there was significant occurrences of civilians being murdered and brutalised by the British, and in fact, you know, the Rising, Tádhg Pearse, the leader of the Rising, decided to surrender because of the high number and increasing numbers of civilian casualties that were being caused by the British.
It was a very solemn ceremony, though. I mean, there are ways to protest without disrupting a ceremony like that in the manner that you did. You could have been outside the cemetery with signs, shouting. Why take the action that you did?
Because of the nature of the events. Like, I mean, you've mentioned there about standing outside the events. If I had done that, I would have been probably half a mile away. Because there was a significant cordon, security cordon on the area with roads closed off. So there was no opportunity to have any relevant impact on the event. So I suppose I felt that, you know, it was an opportunity for me to take some form of direct action. I suppose the nature of the ceremony, and I suppose it's important to point out that, you know, I did make the protest shortly after the event started. You know, and it would have been in my mind that, you know, rather than waiting until the middle of the event when it might have caused, you know, a lot more sort of disruption, I decided that there would be an element at least of respectable protest by doing it at the start. But, you know, I would point out as well, you know, the nature of protest and civil disobedience, very often you can't play within the rules. You know, there's been very many people, and I think even there in Canada, you know, a lot of the entitlements that we have and you have, you know, have come about by people protesting civil disobedience and not playing by the rules as set down by the authorities. So I felt this was the only way I was going to make my voice properly heard.
So we've seen the video, many of us anyway, have seen the video. From your point of view, how did it all go down? What happened?
The ceremony had started. I was seated in sort of the area set aside for people that were attending the event. Just after the initial start of the event and the event was sort of being introduced, I stood up. I had a T-shirt on, which I was using to highlight one of the issues I was hoping to publicise, a campaign called Justice for the Craigavon 2. And I also voiced my disgust and my objection to the event. Now, as I stood away from the seats, from my seat, and went sort of towards the public area in front, I suppose I noticed a gentleman rise from the seat and come sort of fairly quickly towards me. Obviously that was Ambassador Vickers.
Did you know who it was when he stood up?
No. At the time, I didn't. Now, obviously, I have heard, and I would have heard in the past, you know, the events that he was involved in the Parliament there in Canada. And obviously, with them, when he was appointed, you know, the Canadian ambassador to Ireland, but I wouldn't have visually sort of recognised him, you know.
And then what happened? As he dragged you away, I mean, you were screaming and struggling with him.
I suppose these sort of things happen very quickly. I suppose in planning to do that protest, I knew that I might actually, you know, I might get to, say, maybe 20, 30 words before the security or the police that were there were going to, you know, whoosh me out, you know, grab me by the arms and take me away. So it wasn't that I was not expecting some sort of intervention to, you know, to stop the protest. You know, so I was expecting it, but I suppose as he came towards me, I was expecting people to come from behind me, and when he came towards me, my initial thought was that he was some sort of some security or, you know, bodyguard or something. And so I think you can see in the footage, I put my arms out. He grabs me by the lapels of the jacket, and I sort of put my hands out, and I have his jacket, and he sort of propels me sort of back away from the crowd.
Do you hold any grudges against Kevin Vickers for doing what he did?
No. Like, I mean, you know, I've seen a lot of commentary online, and, you know, look, it has come sort of worldwide. You know, I don't, you know, each person reacts differently in a situation, and I think, you know, he's shown in the past, and obviously his, you know, being a sort of former policeman, and that, you know, there's an element of his training that, you know, teaches him to react to situations, and he perceived a situation and perceived that I was a threat, and he acted accordingly, you know. So, yeah, look, you know, what I have pointed out to anybody I've been speaking to, look, you know, certainly there was no use of excessive violence, or, you know, he was basically shoving me. His intention was to get me as far back as possible, which he succeeded in doing, and, you know, there's no hard feelings and I think, like, me and I have said to a lot of people, you know, I should be thanking him, because if it wasn't for his intervention, my sort of small sort of protest would have received little or no publicity apart from, say, the people that were there.
So you think that because Vickers acted the way he did, you're getting much more attention than you ever would have gotten?
No, I'd say I'm getting probably a million times more attention than, you know, would have been the case. I spent today, all last night, non-stop doing interviews to, you know, media from Canada, England, all the different media here. It's a big news story.
Now, your organization has called for an apology. They're calling this an assault. You seem to be taking a different point of view on this, but they want an apology from the government of Canada, and they want the ambassador to be recalled. Do you agree with the call from the organization you represent?
From my perspective, look, I think that's probably a bit much. You know, I think it's probably part of the whole sort of publicity type sort of thing or whatever, but, you know, from a personal point of view, look, I'm not bothered either way.
So you're not looking for an apology or actions against the ambassador as a result?
No, not personally. As I say, on a serious note, like, I mean, really, I should be thanking the ambassador, because, you know, he's the one that's made the publicity on this event. He's turned, you know, what was a small local protest into international news. And, you know, what I would hope is, you know, in particular the Craig Gavin 2 campaign, which, you know, I view as an injustice, and, you know, that there's two innocent guys in prison for the past 7 years, that, you know, if that helps get that message out, and the ambassador has helped us get that message out, well, really, I'd really be thanking him rather than looking for an apology.
That was Brian Murphy, the protester who was tackled by Canada's ambassador to Ireland, Kevin Vickers. Maclean's has extensive coverage of the incident and the debates around it. To read the articles, head to macleans.ca. Still to come on the show, we hear about the two very different political conventions on this weekend. First, we head to Winnipeg for the celebrations at the Liberal gathering, then to Vancouver, where the Conservatives are looking to renew their party. After all of that, we talk about the importance of gender equality as the government looks to reform our electoral system. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Coming up on the show, we take a look at what role gender equality could play as the government starts work on changing the way you vote. But first, this weekend, two parties are gathering for their biennial conventions, and there's a big contrast between the two. The federal Conservatives are looking at ways to renew their movement after being defeated in the last election. Not only that, but they've had to say farewell to their former leader and former Prime Minister Stephen Harper, all while trying to get a feel for the official and potential leadership candidates that hope to take over Harper's job. Now, we'll have more on the Conservative conclave to kick off the second half of our show. But to start our convention coverage, we'll head to Winnipeg, where the federal Liberals have flocked. Many are in a celebratory mood after their huge election win in the fall, jumping from third-party status to majority government. But that doesn't mean there aren't some divisive issues being discussed. Well, to talk more about all of this, I'm joined now by Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes, who is in Winnipeg covering the convention. Tell me a little bit about the feel of the convention, because this is the first big gathering of Liberals after that big election win.
Yeah, I mean, basically, as you'd expect, they're pretty upbeat, a little bit cocky, I would say, almost. But there's also some interesting undercurrents to that celebratory mood. One thing I've noticed is that there's a big presence of the sorts of Liberal officials you would normally think of as being sort of backroom figures at the convention, which is a little unusual. It suggests a sort of emphasis on the sort of organizational clout, the modern sort of campaigning techniques that they're flagging with. They had Katie Telford, who ran the ran the last campaign and is now the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, up giving a keynote speech. That's unusual, Prime. You don't see those kind of people often at these conventions. It's usually elected politicians and that sort of people up. She's the kind of person who normally stays in the back rooms. Nah, she was out front and center today. There's also a kind of undercurrent of unease about a few things, including the changes to the Liberal constitution and some of the hotter issues on the table, including assisted dying. So basically, you know, upbeat, fun, but just with a few wrinkles on the in the picture.
All right, so let's talk about assisted dying first. It's a very controversial topic across the country. There was an attempt to have an emergency resolution put forward on the assisted dying bill that the government has put forward, but the party brass basically put an end to that. What happened there?
Yeah, I mean, the move from the floor here at the convention was to have an emergency debate on it, and their aim was to ask the government to actually make it easier or sort of ease the conditions around which a doctor-assisted death would be allowed. So basically the law that the government has put forward has, some people see it as quite restrictive, and some people here at the Liberal Convention would like to see those limitations loosened. The party decided they didn't want that debated in an emergency debate on the floor. They said it didn't meet their standards for what was required for an emergency resolution to be debated. And some party officials were saying, look, it was crazy to think about debating that motion because it would have suggested that somehow the party was going to be able to dictate to the government, the caucus in Ottawa, that they were going to have to try to amend that bill at this late stage, which just wasn't going to happen. So there's sort of a suggestion that, if you can think of it as a grassroots sentiment that there should have been an emergency debate, it was more a sort of elite sentiment that no, that wasn't productive, so that was quashed.
Was it a large group that was pushing for this, or was it a small group?
Pretty small, I would say, Cormac. It's a little hard to gauge how much sentiment. How much of the sentiment in the room, a lot of people, there are almost 3,000 people here in Winnipeg, how many people would have supported that? But it didn't strike me that was a, I wouldn't call it a groundswell, but there are definitely people here who feel strongly about it.
And on the Constitution matter, how is the Liberal Party handling that?
Well, what they're doing is essentially taking the sort of patchwork of federal, there's the national constitution, the different provincial wings of the party, even some of the specialized branches of the party have their own constitutions. They want to bring that all that together into one document, standardized rules for all the different arms of the Liberal Party across the country. Now, people who don't like the sounds of that think it's a centralizing grab for power from the national part of the party. The people supporting the motion say, no, it's just streamlining the rules, making it clearer. And I think a valid case is being made by the party brass that under the new rules, there would still be provincial boards analogous to the provincial associations now, still be provincial representatives on a national board. Not a crude power grab, Cormac, if it's a power grab at all. It's a sort of a subtle one. And I suspect the party will have to accept it because it's what's wanted by their current brass, including the prime minister. And it's pretty hard for people in the party to balk at something that those guys want these days.
Now, the Liberals had some great success in the last election, going from third to majority government. But at the same time, you look at their system as a party, and unlike the Conservatives and the NDP, they don't have the same type of system set up in terms of databases and the techniques that are used through the elections. And it's been a criticism in the past of the Liberals. Is there work going on behind the scenes there to try and deal with that moving forward?
Absolutely. They feel they've made strides, big strides. And what you've heard a lot of already at the convention, I've heard a lot of people in the party urging rank and file members, sort of activists who are here, to get up to speed with the new computer systems, go to the workshops and seminars they have here on how to fundraise, track your members through social media, all those kinds of contemporary sort of modern techniques. And they've brought in very top people from the digital campaigns of both Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders in the Democratic Party to talk them here, offer a little bit of that sort of U.S. buzz to the thing, which there's always a bit of cachet around here. And also there's, I thought, just this interesting focus on the kinds of people who oversee and are kind of spearheading that kind of campaigning, including Katie Telford, Gerald Butts. Katie Telford has been on stage here. Gerald Butts was featured in a video. These are kind of backroom, sort of normally backroom shadowy figures. And to highlight them this like this, I think has to be part of an effort to try to link the party's sort of activist base with the people who are running the systems, and try to make there be less of a gap between grassroots politics in the party and the sort of elite inner circles.
Lastly, where do we go from here?
I think the interesting thing coming out of this convention will be the degree to which it ends up feeling like what came out of the convention was just a good mood, a big applause for the Prime Minister at his keynote address, a platform for a couple of key figures, including cabinet ministers like Melanie Joly and the chief of staff I've mentioned a couple of times, Katie Telford, or whether or not the mood coming out of here is somewhat more pragmatic and somewhat more focused. That is to say, will people be talking about how much they love the personalities, or will the people in the Liberal Party be talking about how much they learned about digital campaigning, how much they thought about trying to carry over the sort of organizational zeal that went into the 2015 campaign into something that can sustain them through 4 years of power. Now, that's what we'll be trying to sort of gauge. Has the party sort of dug in for a sort of disciplined endurance run to the next campaign, or are they still sort of riding high on what is the inevitable sort of euphoria of a win?
All right. Thanks very much, John. I really appreciate you joining us on this.
Great. Thanks, Cormac.
That was McLean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes covering the Federal Liberal Convention in Winnipeg. To see John's work on this, head to mcleans.ca and check out next week's issue of McLean's Magazine. Still to come on the show, we go from the Liberals in Winnipeg to the Conservatives in Vancouver and check out the Tory convention. We also take a look at what role gender equality will play as the government changes our electoral system. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. Still to come on the show, we take a look at gender equality and how that issue may factor into the work that will be done to change Canada's electoral system. But first, the Liberals aren't the only ones who have gathered for a party convention. On Thursday, Conservatives made their way to Vancouver, where they held their first meeting of the membership since losing the fall election to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and his Liberals. There's a lot of talk of renewal, but before delegates got down to that kind of work, they said goodbye to their former leader, former Prime Minister Stephen Harper. After a video tribute of his 10 years in office, Harper spoke publicly for the first time since losing that vote. He thanked the membership and his team, he went over his list of accomplishments, and ended with a message of unity.
In a year, you will select from among many outstanding candidates a new leader, and you will unite behind that person, because in 2019, perhaps more than we understand even now, our country will need a strong, united Conservative Party ready to govern. It will need a party driven by hope, by hard work, and by higher purpose, that Canada can be and must always be the best country in the world. And I know that you will succeed in that for our party, for our country. The best is yet to come. Merci beaucoup. God bless.
To talk more about the Conservative convention, I spoke with McLean's associate editor, Nancy McDonald, on Friday. Nancy is covering the convention for the magazine. Nancy, thank you very much for joining us on the show this week.
Thanks so much for having me, Cormac. I appreciate this.
Yeah, so you're on the ground at the convention, the Conservative gathering in Vancouver. I'll ask you the same first question I asked John Geddes about the Liberal convention. What is the mood like on the floor? It obviously, the Liberals are celebrating their win, so there's some optimism there. But the Conservatives just went through a poor election loss. They're in a state of renewal. What's it like on the floor?
Well, you know, ahead of the conversation, there was a lot of talk about doom and gloom and, how this was going to be a kind of, funeral for conservatives. And I'd say that's far from the mood here. There are vibrant debates happening over same-sex marriage on all kinds of issues. I think the people I've spoken with talk about this as being a time of renewal. This is the first time in, since Stephen Harper merged the parties a decade ago that they've chosen a new leader. And so there are all kinds of policy debates happening on issues that, that we don't necessarily expect from conservatives. I mean, a big talking point here is a green policy for the party. We're seeing the party's definition of marriage as one woman and one man being debated and possibly being, annexed from their constitution. So there's a, there's a lot of debate happening, but this is not a doom and gloom event.
They're feeling the sense of renewal and they're looking to move on after such a stinging loss. And part of that is to say goodbye to the man who led the party throughout its whole time as the modern conservative party. That was Stephen Harper. Is there a lot of love there for Stephen Harper, or is the focus mainly on moving on?
Look, there was a rousing ovation for him yesterday. There did feel, feel like there was a fair amount of love in the room last night. But the conversation today is not about Mr. Harper. It's not even really about Mr. Harper's legacy. It's about what comes next and, where this party goes in the next 4 years.
And you had mentioned some of those issues, talking about a green strategy, gay marriage. These are things that Harper had fought against, or at least didn't address, whether he was fighting against them or not, as prime minister. Is there a feeling that there needs to be a big step away from the stance of the Conservative Party under Stephen Harper to where it goes next?
Well, look, I haven't heard anyone voice that explicitly, but that certainly seems to be what they're doing. Monty Solberg, a former Harper cabinet minister last night, told us that, everyone under 40 understands the importance of climate change. They're not debating that this is happening. And he said, we as a party need to accept that and understand that this is a very important issue that we need to play a leadership role on. So while they may not be saying they're moving away from where Harper had been taking the party, that they're certainly doing it.
That is also reflective in the debate that's happened about gay marriage and modernizing the party's stance on that issue, where you have a larger, younger contingent of the party saying, listen, we need to get with the times. We can't just, move away. We can't just stick with the same policies we've had for a very long time. While others say it is essential that they don't neglect the portion of the party that still feels that gay marriage is a wrong approach.
Yeah, we saw that play out today. And, the two MPs who are at the forefront of this are Michelle Rempel, a Calgary Nose Hill MP, who I believe tabled the bill to scrap that definition, that conservative definition of marriage. Her opponent would be Brad Trost, MP from Saskatoon, who believes that traditional marriage is the bedrock of society and that he said, you cannot have a functioning free enterprise society without it. He feels that the party will become liberal light. And what is the point of this party if only to mimic what the liberals are doing? So two very, very different stances on this. But Michelle Rempel's position did win the day. But like you're saying, like the younger people here, and not just the younger people, there seems to be an understanding among a lot of people that this is, gay rights and conservatism can and do go hand in hand.
So this is basically a policy convention, not the leadership convention that will come next year. But have you been noticing the leadership campaigns at work hard on the ground talking to members? Because this will be the last major gathering of conservatives before that vote in May of next year.
Sure. I mean, it has started. You can see it. There were dozens of delegates who turned up in blue draft Rona T-shirts yesterday. There was a draft Rona hospitality suite. People are certainly talking about her. Maxime Bernier, the Quebec MP, was certainly working the room, as was Peter McKay. who's, you know, unlike Bernier, he's just a suggested candidate at this point. But Kelly Leach, who's also thrown her name into the ring, she's also been working the room and talking to people openly. So, you know, it has started. But I think when you ask people who they're willing to support, most people are saying at this point they're just going to sit back and wait until people throw their names in the ring, because we've only got three declared candidates at this point. So there's a lot, you know, there's a long way to go yet.
And I guess all eyes are on those potential candidates to see what their actions are and whether they decide to join the fray or not, and whether they're organizing right now behind the scenes at this convention. What have you noticed from the likes of, let's say, Kevin O'Leary, Jason Kenney, Lisa Raitt, Tony Clement, some of the other big names that that have been tossed around as potential candidates?
Right, okay. Well, Jason Kenney last night was kind of working the sides of the room, certainly not as visible as the Kelly Leeches and the Michael Trongs. Kevin O'Leary arrives today. There's a fair amount of interest here about him. You know, he's not a Conservative Party member. This is going to be new for him and for the party. But I don't know. People seem to be excited about this voice, and you know, some people are also deeply skeptical of it.
When it comes to challenges moving forward, because, you know, setting some party policies is one thing, but they really need to do battle with the Liberals, with this younger, dynamic prime minister who, yes, may still be having controversies of his own, but it doesn't seem so far to have affected his popularity amongst Canadians. So how have they been talking in terms of handling the situation of Justin Trudeau and his team of Liberals?
Well, I mean, I think you know, these issues that have suddenly become front and center in Conservative minds, marriage equality, environmental rights, climate change, I think they've come to realize how important these issues are for young Canadians. Michelle Rempel was also talking today about the you know, some of the divisive things that occurred in the last election over the NECAB and over the cultural barbaric cultural practices initiative, and you know, she frankly feels they went in the wrong direction with that, and I think there is a fair amount of discussion about that and about what needs to happen to communities that they feel they have treated unfairly. So I think you know, no one is here seems to be talking a lot about that 2015 election, but you know, it's done, and there were lessons to be learned, and you know, everyone's watching Justin Trudeau and seeing him connect, and I think you know, that's an enviable position to be in, and I imagine they're looking to capitalize on that in the same way he has
on the issue of the NECAB or the hotline. You know, that may have turned off many new Canadian voters that otherwise may have considered the Conservative. So what are there any efforts that you've noticed to try and draw back some of the new Canadians to the Tory fold?
Well, I mean, Michelle Rempel is among those who think that they really need to try to repair the damage done and try to build bridges with those communities. But then you've got people, I spoke with Chris Alexander yesterday, who was one of the people, along with Kelly Leach, who introduced that. And, you know, he doubled down. He feels there is nothing to apologize for. He feels there was no error made. He feels what happened was only a communication problem, that that their message somehow got mixed up. But he feels that that was excellent policy. So there are splits within the party. You know, there are some who feel they've done wrong and others who feel they've done no wrong.
Is there anything else you'd like to add? Any other observations from the convention floor?
One thing I really have noticed is the treatment of media. Everything here is open. All of the caucus, you know, all of the plenary sessions are open to media, which is very different than what's happening at the Liberal convention, where a number of these sessions are closed. The Conservative team has been very open with media, very helpful.
And very different from Conservative conventions of the past.
Yeah, and just, you know, in dealings with Conservative staff members in the past as well, yeah.
All right. Very interesting indeed to see the changes that are happening and the push for renewal within the Conservative Party. Nancy MacDonald, thank you so much for your observations and your thoughts on all of this.
Thank you, Cormac.
That was Maclean's associate editor, Nancy MacDonald, at the Conservative Party convention in Vancouver. To read Nancy's work, head to macleans.ca or pick up next week's issue of Maclean's magazine. Coming up after the break, how will gender equality be a factor in the upcoming changes to Canada's voting system? We ask the head of Equal Voice Canada. Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio. The federal government is currently in the process of setting up a committee that will study different ways to change Canada's voting system. During the last election, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau promised that the October vote would be the last one using the first-past-the-post system. Now, some of the options being considered could include proportional representation and a ranked ballot system. The committee may also look at mandatory or online voting. Its final recommendations won't be released until December. But as all these discussions are being held, there is an opportunity to make gender equality a focus. While there have been great strides in recent years for equality, women are still drastically underrepresented in the House of Commons. To talk more about all of this, I'm joined on the phone now by Nancy Peckford, who is the head of Equal Voice. She is currently in Winnipeg, acting as an observer at the Liberal Convention. Nancy, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Not a problem.
All right, so the Liberal government is looking at electoral reform, and I'm wondering how you think equality can play into the discussions that are going to be had around changing the way Canadians vote.
Well, certainly I think gender equality is an important consideration, and we are encouraged to see that the consultation framework obviously recognizes the importance of getting more women into politics. So I think it's very germane to this discussion, and a lot potentially can be achieved depending on how the electoral system overall is reformed.
Is there any one system or anything you'd like to see that you think would actually make a difference when it comes to equality?
Well, there are a lot of different systems that are used around the world that are potentially a departure from first past the post, which is a system we use in Canada. And many of them do appear to enable parties to do a better job of identifying candidates who are women. But we don't see any particular system as a silver bullet because we think that the parties themselves also have to adapt their cultures and ensure, certainly at the recruitment stage, that there are more women coming forward who successfully secure their name either on a list, which is what a proportional representation system would use, or on a ballot.
Do you believe a quota of women candidates would be an answer to something like this as these discussions are being had?
Yeah, well, obviously a quota is arguably very effective and efficient way to achieve a greater representation of women. But again, if you look at countries that use quotas, it really depends on the context and the cultures of the parties themselves in terms of how they leverage a quota to recruit and engage dynamic and strong women. So obviously a quota, is a very, very short route to political parity, but regardless of the system, what appears to be quite important is that the women themselves feel that they are credible and equal representatives within the legislatures that they sit in. So the system is only part of the equation. The culture, the political culture in which they serve is equally as relevant because it affects their potential to be influential political actors once they are elected.
Now, let's look at some of the other issues being discussed. There's mandatory voting, as well as online voting. Do you think that those would have any impact at all when it comes to electing more women to Parliament?
Yes, I don't think that we see those particular mechanisms as particularly helpful. There is some research that suggests that mandatory voting can backfire in certain cases because you then penalize people for not participating in the democratic process, and that comes with its own set of implications. So I think in our view, they're not as relevant to electing more women as a change to the electoral system could be, and also a change to the culture within parties that is very important to how women come to those parties and see themselves as prospective candidates within those parties. And of course, you also have the issue of the current terms under which members of parliament, if you're speaking federally, serve, and Equal Voice, in fact, has come out with a 5-point plan to really modify some of the ways that parliament currently functions that we feel create unnecessary burdens for women and men both, who have significant caregiving responsibilities, a large commute because they serve in a riding inside of, the GTA Montreal Quarter. There are lots of other ways in which we think we should support those who are elected, because ultimately they are the women and men who go out and tell others that this job is really worthwhile and productive and that it's satisfying work. Equal Voice believes that, in fact, the current staffing complement for most MPs who are not ministers or parliamentary secretaries is very, very limited, and that, in fact, the workload in and of itself is not really sustainable for many who get into the job who have competing responsibilities in their private lives.
So you think that on top of changing the electoral system, there needs to be changes for better accommodation within Parliament itself?
Yeah, but Parliament is nearly a 150-year-old institution, and many of its norms are defined, well before this century and often before the last. So the norms and principles at play in terms of sitting hours, the kinds of supports provided to staff, the amount of travel, the underutilization of certain technologies, which would allow MPs, to serve sometimes from their riding when they're participating in debates and other things, I think are such that we have to revisit how Parliament itself functions on a day-to-day basis.
And lastly for you, you're at the Liberal Convention observing there as a part of your organization.
Yes.
Have you met with the minister responsible for this? Have you talked to other MPs about these issues?
Absolutely. We talk all the time. And in fact, we have members of our team at the Conservative Party Convention in Vancouver. So we've been fanning out across the country. Absolutely, we've had lots of opportunities to interact with a number of key ministers, who obviously address issues that are germane to our file.
And what has the response been?
Oh, people are obviously very open. We also are here to promote our national initiative, Daughters of the Vote, which is to bring 338 young women to Ottawa to sit in the House of Commons next March 8th on International Women's Day and to take their seat in the House. So that's a major leadership initiative for us, and we've been working with MPs across parties and across the political spectrum to ensure that they are aware of that opportunity and encourage young women between the ages of 18 and 23 to apply to participate in a fairly groundbreaking initiative, which will again force the conversation of what it means to have more women involved in politics.
That was Nancy Peckford with Equal Voice discussing the importance of gender equality as the government looks at changing our electoral system. Well, that's it for this week's episode. For more of your politics and power, join us next week on The Hill.